It is March 19th, 2011, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast. Today on Geek Speak, we'll be talking about, the nuclear reactor in Japan, and the first half of the show we'll be doing the week in geek news. It's time now for Geek Speak.
Geek Speak is a production of KUSP, Central Coast Public Radio, kusp.org. The bandwidth for geekspeak.org is provided by GNI, gnihosting.com.
Join the car guys, Click and Clack, the Tappet Brothers, for advice on things automotive and just about everything else on Sunday mornings at 9 a.m. right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. Geek Speak on KUSP is supported by Home and Small Business Tech, providing IT support to businesses and tech support for home computers. Home and Business Tech specializing in protecting data and have been providing data storage, recovery, virtualization, and maintenance for over 10 years. HASBtech.com. Today on Geek Speak, we're going to have our guest... Professor Christian Shorey. He's a doctor in geology, geoscience. He has a wonderful podcast about earth and marine, earth and environmental science. We'll be joining him in about a half an hour to talk, about nuclear energy and the effects of the catastrophe in Japan, what's happened, what's going on. We'll be talking about that in about a half an hour. But first, I want to welcome our local geeks who are actually in the air room with me, Mr. Miles Elam. He's a programmer and political junkie. Good morning.
Good morning.
You're on too.
Good morning.
That was beautiful. I love it. Even when I don't mess up, you help me. Thank you. No, just kidding. And we also have Ben Jaffe. Ben, it's been a while. Hi.
It has been a while. It has indeed.
And lately you're teaching again?
Yeah, I've been teaching. I've been freelancing. I've been doing some HTML5 stuff, trying to catch up with Miles over there. And
good luck on that. I've been trying to do that for years.
Yeah, it's hopeless.
Miles, what's your first news story, sir?
Oh, you're going to start with me, huh?
Yeah.
Well, I guess I just wanted to do that little public service announcement, considering all the news has talked about NPR being defunded, or the House of Representatives voting to defund NPR, all $5 million of it, just to... Because my New Year's resolution was to impart some math concept to folks. I guess I'll
do... talking about percentages?
I'll do everyone right now. So if you do 5 million of our current budget shortfall, or rather the federal budget, you get 1/10,000th of 1%.
That's not very much, sir.
Which is the Congressional Budget Office ran the numbers and calculated that it will have, quote, no effect.
Wait, who said it? Who said cutting all public funding for broadcast?
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. So whenever something is proposed, the Congressional Budget Office will run through the accounting on it, run through the numbers, and say this is going to be projected to save this much money
and this part,
in 10 years.
This body is part of the Congress. They report to the Congress specifically for this kind of, what's this effect going to be? They give the numbers.
Yes.
It's the kind of people that when you are trying to vote on a bill or something and it's going to do certain things, those numbers come from that kind of office, right? It's a non-positive, partisan kind of idea.
Yes. About their whole point is the fact that they are nonpartisan. They are this federally funded.
It's close to the truth
they
just
take.
Kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
So they said there'll be no effect.
Well, it's not that hard to really project that 1/10,000th of 1% is not really going to have a larger effect
on the economy. It's like me drinking my coffee over here and I'm enjoying my coffee, and it's going to affect me, you know, my caffeine levels and all that, and my mood will change. But if I take a human hair, and dip it into the coffee, and then pull it out and drop that on, you know, throw that away, that difference, the amount of coffee I'm going to drink.
No. We're talking about the amount of coffee that evaporates into the air as you move the hair to the trash can.
So what you're saying is whether I drink it straight from the cup or I use a spoon, even if I drink exactly the same amount, from my perspective, that's the difference, just because of the movement through the air. Wow.
You're being too generous, Lyle.
I am.
Yeah.
And like, just to give some perspective on this, okay, so the funding for National Public Radio, and this hasn't passed the Senate and hasn't passed the president's desk, so this is just the House. It isn't law. But $5 million, we're in a budget deficit, so it's still $5 million. Sure. Billion here, billion there. You're talking about real money. The war in Afghanistan is $10 billion, $10 billion with a B, whereas NPR was $5 million with an M. So $10 billion per month is the war in Afghanistan. And, yeah, just want to put things into perspective there.
Well, thanks for that math analysis. Does that count for your today's math education?
Well, actually, no. I tutored someone in math earlier this week, so that's actually...
Okay, so it's weekly. That's right. You're supposed to teach somebody about math every week.
Right. So I'm actually doubling up.
That's good. And if you don't, and that's your what is it called? New Year's resolution.
Yes.
Mine has been to take a photograph every day of the year. On GeekSpeak, it's to ask questions, more leading questions. And I've been doing it. I've been taking a photograph of a new person every single day of the year. Ben, I started with your brother, which good looking brother.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it looks a lot like you. Hi, what's your news story?
Hey there. I actually have a news story also about the House and what the House has been doing. Mm. They very recently voted down a simple amendment that declared the reality of climate change. Now, that's not saying climate change is anthropogenic or any of that. It just says that climate change exists, right? That phenomenon exists, and they voted it down.
Who did this?
House Republicans. It was completely on party lines.
Why are they stating whether something exists or not?
So the amendment was presented by Henry Waxman, Democrat of California, to the Energy and Commerce Committee, and it was just – I mean, it was a number of things. One amendment was saying that climate change exists, right? Because – I don't know. You can't be too careful.
Our guest has a lot of knowledge about this, by the way, about climate change. Mm-hmm, but maybe we'll bring that up. Of course, we won't be talking about Japan at all.
And so everyone realizes, science is always decided by popular vote.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
If you have a vote, then you change science.
So that's the issue, right?
What temperature is 1C? Well, it's a cubic centimeter.
Right? No,
well, it's kind of like It's kind of like I can't remember what state it was. I talked about it like a year ago, but. Some state decided to pass an amendment to their something that changed the value of pi from 3.1415 to 3.
And then, making simpler, yeah.
And then in another similar move, another state, I think Illinois or Arkansas or something, voted that Pluto was indeed a planet.
Good.
Because they have the authority to do that, you know. They know their astronomy.
I went to the ANSA College with my Wyatt's class, and we took a whole look at the planetarium and did this whole, you know, walkthrough. And, of course, the slides and the video that was being played had Pluto. And halfway through the Pluto presentation, the thing went, and stopped. And I was like, no, Pluto. And I was realizing, I kept on saying it's not a planet. And Wyatt's like, yes, it is, Dad. It's a dwarf planet. I'm like, right, I guess it's a planet. It's just a dwarf planet. And I hold sentimental value. To him, it's just another type of body. You know, he's like, it's a dwarf planet, Dad. Okay, yeah, I guess it's a planet. It's a different type of planet.
Wow, that's
shut
fantastic.
Shut down, but then you're
like, I know. Good job. No, but yeah, it's. I guess to me it's just really troubling because, I mean, there was another amendment that was saying that climate change is anthropogenic. And, I mean, there's not really much debate in the scientific community, but at least there are a couple people with PhDs in dentistry who are saying that, you know,
whether it's man,
yeah, man caused or largely
it's definitely
man
happening.
Caused.
We're definitely going to climate. We're definitely going to climate change.
So sure, you know, I can accept that one being voted down, but for the House to vote on party lines, Republicans voting against science.
Against the facts.
Yeah, like they could repeal the law of gravity next, you know?
Well, in fairness, I do want to have some fairness here, which is even though like I am very much on the side of, yes, the overwhelming scientific consensus is that climate change is real and anthropogenic. But at the same time, that amendment that was brought up by Waxman was, I mean, that was a political stunt. It had no legal like standing. It had there was nothing binding about it. It was merely a political stunt. So
he
I just want to throw that
himself,
out there just out of fairness, because it was a stunt on both ends.
I see. Right. I get what you're saying.
Sure. Sure. It just is. I don't know.
It's sad to hear.
Why are there stunts in politics? Why does it happen that way?
that is a good question.
Why can't they just do their job?
I mean, there have been other amendments and other issues that where this has happened where it hasn't been so clear cut. So this is, I don't know. To me, I just kind of see it as, and sure, it was a stunt, absolutely. And sure, it makes sense that, you know, oh, yeah, well, you're doing that. Well, we're gonna vote it down. Yeah, you know, right. But it just seems silly. So.
Yeah, right. And when you say, why are there so many stunts like that? Why is that in politics?
Because people like us talk about it.
No, actually, I was thinking more along the lines of because most people of voting age don't vote, and those who do overwhelmingly do it based upon an emotion that they got from watching a TV ad rather than looking at an issue as an actual bill.
What else are they going to do, kind of, if they don't argue about it, things like that? All
right,
let's
so
let's
if we
on.
Voted better people in, we that's, wouldn't have to
true.
See that.
It's true. Mr. Miles Elam, it's your turn, sir. And since we're not – you guys aren't on the wiki thing that we use to chat, and so I'm like,
yeah, I've been using,
you're flying blind.
Your segues are a little stale.
I know. And now we'll talk about robots with Miles. Oh, that's not what we're talking about? Damn it.
So we talk about stories like this every once in a while about spam and the amount of spam out there, and you know, spam is up, spam is down. It's kind of like a stock market. I don't know. So Microsoft is taking a leading position in trying to take down spam. They're not the only ones, but they're one of those companies that's out there that has a vested interest in trying to make spam less intrusive on their systems. Microsoft making an email client and an email server, so they're in the fight, as it were. Well, Microsoft's taken a leading role in taking down a spam giant known as Rustic. And just by taking down that one spam outfit, worldwide spam reduced by 39%.
Wow.
At the same time,
one sender was doing almost 40%.
That is actually a normal thing I've found over the years, is that one gets taken down, there's a nice, very nice dip in spam for a very short time until everyone starts to coalesce on other ISPs that are willing to take their place. And then they get taken down, and then so this happens periodically. At the same time, it's still nice to hear that 39% of all spam has disappeared from the net for a very short period of time.
It just makes me kind of teary-eyed. Thank you, Miles, so much.
You want
for
a
that.
Tissue?
No, I'm good. Ben?
I have a fantastic story. It is actually, and this is rare for me to cover a computer game, because I typically don't. But this is a game called URL Hunter. And you play this game in the URL bar of your web browser. So, you know, normally you would go to a website and you'd play in the normal area where you see content. But the place that you type in, google.com or whatever, that's where the game is played, right? So basically it's and actually I'm playing it right now while I'm talking to you guys. It's a whole bunch of dashes after the URL. There are a whole bunch of dashes there. And also a little counter. And along the dashes, a bunch of A's are moving around, right? And they're kind of trying to avoid you. And you play an O. And you have to move the O with the arrow key and hit spacebar when you're over an A to kill the A. And you have to kill as many A's as possible. So it's kind of like almost like Pac-Man, but one-dimensional and played in a URL bar.
Great. And you'll have this the game up on our site?
I will indeed have the game up on the site.
All the stuff we talk about is up on geekspeak.org.
Or will be shortly.
I want to mention something that I thought is kind of funny. This guy by the name of I think I'll just call Kenneth Ritz. He had his whole genome sequenced. I'm not sure how or why, probably one of these outfits, and they gave him the text document that represented his genome. And he went ahead and put it up on GitHub, which is a repository open source, well, not necessarily open source, but he made an open source repository of his genome so that anyone can fork his genome and modify it just by text, if you will. So I went ahead and did a copy of that, but I love his permissions license on his genome. Miles, you'll dig this. Permission is hereby granted free of charge to any person obtaining a copy of this sequence to deal with it without restriction, except for uses related to genetic cloning, partial or whole. If a clone is sought to be made, a $20 per day of life fee must be paid to Kenneth Ritz or closest kin until the clone's 18th OOT, out of tube, anniversary. After that, a 10% royalty of all the clone's personal business income shall be paid to Kenneth Ritz. So he's making his genome completely open and available, but if you make a clone, you got to give him royalties, which is kind of awesome. all right, let's go on to Mr. Miles Elam, your story, sir.
Oh, now I'm actually like running into a problem. I have like a couple of jokes handy, but I don't know if I want to bring
it
up.
Go for it.
Okay, the BBC gets some style points. They were talking about net neutrality. It's a topic we've talked about on Geek Speak regularly. And on their headline, when they were talking about ISPs defending the plan for a two-tier net, they said, "In quote, in a heated debate about net neutrality, ISPs argue that all traffic is equal, but some is more equal than others."
It's good.
If you get that reference, good on you. You've read a book.
Miles, last week you closed the show with like one little tidbit of reference what questions to geeks are if they were translated into questions to doctors.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't explain that exactly. So the general idea is that doctors...
Wait. Can we hear the tidbit again really quickly?
If he remembers, case? I don't want to put him on the spot.
I don't have them all packed away.
Ben, why do you do that?
I thought you memorized all of them.
But basically the idea of that, you know, when you're in the room with a doctor...
I was talking about on a forum, like online. Yeah. Someone
but
posts
in
a
general,
forum, yeah.
the etiquette when you talk to a doctor is you're not. It's polite not to go into a detailed conversation with them about your medical history because they get paid to do that. So instead, you set up an appointment and go visit them at their clinic, and then they work on you.
Yeah, it has things like. Yeah. So do I want to pay all that much to have my kidney transplant? My cousin says he'll do it for really cheap.
And this is the thing: as geeks, there doesn't seem to be that etiquette, and people have these really great ideas they want to come up with. So they come up and say, you know, I really want to – I'm planning on making this robot, and I just need to know how I can, let it reproduce on its own. Can you help me with that? And you're like, what? Huh? And that's like a programming question generally. So these jokes are all kind of trying to translate that.
Or the best one is the one on Craigslist that says, I have this great idea for a Facebook killer. Don't have any funding yet, but if you could just
– Yeah. Kidding line.
It's going to go far.
Ben, your turn, sir.
Yeah, so I want to cover a long shot theory by a couple of physics professors, Tom Wheeler and Chui Man Ho. And Wheeler is a physics professor at Vanderbilt. And he says, yeah, our theory doesn't make very much sense. Like, it makes sense. It's a long shot, but it doesn't violate any fundamental laws of physics or experimental constraints. So what their theory is that the Large Hadron Collider, which is the largest machine ever built by man, most people would agree, and a particle accelerator. So you smash particles together and create these immense explosions and try and generate these particles that wouldn't be able to typically exist in normal conditions. Their theory is that the collider may actually be able to create the elusive Higgs boson, which they've been looking for, and create a second particle called the Higgs singlet. And the Higgs singlet, they predict, may actually be able to travel through time. Now, this seems really bizarre because, you know, a lot of us think, okay, well, if you can travel through time, you know, you could go back in time and, you know, kill your grandmother and then you would never be born and all
you
of
know,
these.
Grandparents always get the rap with time travel.
Why not just kill your parents instead?
Or just not kill anybody, you know? Give somebody donut and see what happens to the timeline.
Yeah.
You know, who knows?
Give
but why do you
donut?
Have to kill somebody? It's just so mean.
And then your father never met your mother. And
that's
then,
right. You have no idea.
Yeah, anyway. So they created this theory, which I, as someone who has never studied particle physics, couldn't hope to really understand. But basically, the gist of it is they've created this theory, and it doesn't violate any of these any of these paradoxes or create any of these paradoxes because only these particles, these singlets, can actually potentially travel back or forward in time.
I think the temporal linearity of our experience is one of those wonderful mysteries in science. That,
yeah.
You know, the more you learn about it, the more you go, well, why is it like that? It shouldn't be like that. It's so interesting.
Yeah. I learned all of it from watching Star Trek and seeing Kirk travel back with Spock and whatnot to 1960 whatever and do all kinds of bizarre things and then go back and their universe is exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Ben,
I personally love the fact that Star Trek always kind of changed the rules. Sometimes they went back in time and they changed the future. Other times they went back in time and they just changed an alternate universe.
Right, right. It was okay.
An alternate timeline.
I have to say I'm geeky and enough of a Trekkie to have tracked these things, and they're not the least bit consistent. Like, if you were to go by one theory or another
fiction would be consistent.
You'd think that a sci-fi show from the 60s would be rigorous.
Hey, not just the 60s.
Miles,
the 80s,
and Ben,
too.
And is your scientific knowledge like 20% enforced by or started by Star Trek? Or more like a 30%?
I read a really great book called The Physics of Star Trek by a real physicist who was talking about all these things. Yeah, you know that book?
Yeah,
have you read it?
No.
Read it. It's fantastic. Yeah. It'll change
Lyle doesn't
life.
Read.
There's other things to read. They're so much better.
So this is the thing that I find really interesting, though. In this interview, he said, quote, because time travel is limited to these special particles, it's not possible for a man to travel back in time and murder one of his parents before he himself is born, for example.
What about little small man? Really, really
small man. However, we need Rick Moranis and the Honey, I Shrunk the Kids device thing going on. Then he goes on to say, however, if scientists could control the production of Higgs singlets, they might be able to send messages to the past or future. So that seems to me like it would change.
If you send information to the past, still can do that.
So I must be missing something or whatnot. Yeah. Maybe sending messages to the future, but sending messages to the past, theoretically.
I mean, just sending a small message could totally. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Maybe you could send a message which could only be interpreted at the time that you sent it, but you could actually send it back in time.
Well, then that's not really anything, is it?
I know.
Thanks, Mr.
Well, anyway.
Jaffe.
Bizarre story.
Miles, we got time for one more wonderful news story from you, sir. And
okay,
I'd love to promote it and everything, but I have no idea what you're going to say.
I will do a very short blurb because we're always beating up on telecoms and cable companies, which are kind of telecoms right now.
Same
anyway.
Thing.
I felt like I'd give a shout out to Verizon because recently Verizon has done something that I wholeheartedly approve of, which is when the disaster, the earthquake and tsunami happened in Japan. Verizon's cable service popped up a box saying access to TV Japan will be free for limited time, tuned to channel and in support of disaster relief efforts in Japan, Verizon customers can call Japan free through April 10th.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
That's a month.
Yeah, that's nice that they did that.
So yeah, that's wonderful.
Are they promoting it a lot?
Well, this, like I said, it was a big pop-up that showed up on their cable on their cable service.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so that's one of those things where
TV service, I should call it.
Is the marketing level for that for Verizon high enough where that makes sense financially just from a marketing perspective, right?
Well, the word of mouth through Geekspeak apparently is.
It's working this way.
I know. Everyone listens to this show.
All right. Well, okay. Great.
But, you know, you want to give credit where credit is due. Like, yes, many telecoms do things that I personally have disagreed with or and talked about, but at the same time, I want to talk about when they're doing good things as well. Things that, you know, someone in their position are one of the few people that can do things on this scale.
Yeah.
And they are stepping up.
Yeah, definitely.
You're listening to Geekspeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. KOSP co-sponsors Lightfoot Industries Super Club at its new location starting Saturday, March 26th at Dig Gardens and Design 420 Water Street in downtown Santa Cruz. Super Clubs will continue through Saturday, May 28th, with one seating on Saturday nights at 6. The new location brings new chef Kevin Kabil to manage the Lightfoot Kitchen with appearances from guests, chefs, and speakers. Diners will enjoy a pre-dinner cocktail and shop hour, followed by a five-course family-style meal served by Lightfoot teen apprentices. Information at lightfootinn.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. Today, our guest is Christian Shorey. We'll be speaking with him in just a moment. about, well, a lot of amazing things. It's hard to get into right now, but when I introduce him in a second, you'll learn all about that. But first, Miles, a geek bit, would you?
Yes, remind me what I was going to do for my geek bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, I guess it's really more of a correction than a geek bit.
Yes, the correction is last week we talked about vacuuming out your computer of dust and things like that because that's one of the main problems for overheating and for some problems that can show up with your computer, especially intermittent errors.
Yeah.
And
the
correction
idea being
is
there's dust and dirt inside there. The airflow is not as good, so it can shut off.
Right. We were using vacuum as a generic term, but it was that was a term that we should not have used.
Well, in the sense that I was talking about getting the dust out of there, get a vacuum and get the dust out of there and go and get an air can if you can and spray it out.
Right.
And the concern was that if you stick a vacuum in there, you could damage the computer.
Well, no, not necessarily damage the computer. Yes, you could if you, like, start slamming up to things. But in general, it would be okay from that standpoint. The problem is that some high-powered vacuums in a small area can suck up a jumper, for example.
Right.
Or, you know, some little parts that are in
hardware
there that
setting
may not
in
be,
there, not so good.
Yeah, or loosen some connections and stuff
now,
like that. That's
when you're using the vacuum, do you want to have the on-carpet setting or non-carpet setting?
What you want to do is you want to go get the device that is made for this, which is called really crazy
computer
technical
sucker.
Term, yeah. An air can, compressed air can.
Right. Which we did mention last week.
Yeah. So you do go there, you buy this can that has compressed air in it compressed gas. Yeah. And then so you're actually blowing things out.
And the trick with this is when you do this, you're going to make plumes of dust.
Yes.
If you have a vacuum handy close by, you can kind of angle that to collect a lot of that dust rather than spreading all around.
What you'd want to do is you want to take your computer outside.
Yeah.
And then do the air can outside so all the dust is blown outside.
When it's not raining.
Make sure there's no lightning storms. Make sure,
Make sure you're not in any sandstorms.
All the eventualities.
Watch out for hail. Snow is probably right out as well.
Careful of animals.
Mudslides, avoid those.
All right, thanks for the correction from last week. Today, our guest is Dr. Christian Shorey. Christian has a PhD in geoscience from University of Iowa, a BS in geology, and a minor in zoology from University of Texas. He focuses on his research projects in modeling the climate controls in our environment by looking at slagtite slagmites, cave formation materials, and the isotopes that get embedded into those to look at long distance. What?
You just sidestepped. You're like, I can't do that word. I'm just going to talk about what it is.
But you know what? I bet Christian can. Hi, Christian. Welcome to Geekspeak. Wrong one. Hi, Christian. Sorry about that. Welcome to Geekspeak.
Hey, how are you doing, man? Good to talk to you.
Now, Christian, I know about you because of your wonderful Earth Environmental Science podcast.
Wait.
What?
How do you say the word?
Speleothems.
Thank you.
Yes.
You know, I said it in my head so well. And speleothems are rock formations in caves produced by deposits from water?
Yep, exactly. It's usually calcium carbonate deposits, and my specialty was looking at the rate of growth and also isotopic incorporation of carbon and oxygen isotopes to try to get an idea of what the climate above the cave was doing as the speleothem was growing underground. So that was my main research.
And welcome to Geekspeak, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, thank you so much.
And Christian, specifically, what's going on there is that you'll see seasonal rings, kind of like in a tree growth of a slagmite or stalactite structure. You'll actually see that happen because there's more water flow in the rainy months, and so therefore you've got like a pattern that you can see. And then also you have pollen gets trapped in these, lots of other things, right?
Oh, yes. Organic acids pulse through every spring, and if you hit them with a laser, you can see them fluoresce, and they just, exactly like you said, like tree rings, marking your years. You know when the speleothem was collected, you just count these things back, and you know exactly what year the material was deposited in each one of these bands. And
it's a really nice record. How old of a timeline can you get from an active system?
My colleagues, the oldest I've heard is about 240,000 years old, something like that.
That's pretty fantastic, though, to see climate patterns all the way back, or weather patterns all the way back to that. That's great. Have you been in caves lately? Have you been spelunking?
I don't know if I can officially call it a cave. I was in a fracture cave recently. It's a granite one, not a limestone one. But, planning going on some more.
Fantastic.
Soon.
Now, this podcast that you did, which I highly recommend, it's up on the GeekSpeak website. Go check out Christian's podcast. If you're a geek, you're going to love it. My girlfriend turned me on to it years ago and listened to every one of them. And whenever I have a question about a certain topic, I go back and listen to that episode. Your whole discussion on, I think there's probably four episodes on climate change and what it actually means. And at the beginning of the show, Ben mentioned that there was a recent legislation about whether climate change exists or not. And of course, they're trying to legislate whether it exists, which is, of course, frustrating. But if you have questions about that, as a listen to Christian's podcast. It's a fantastic way of, kind of breaking it all down. But it is 7 years old, or sorry, it is 4 years old. What's changed? And are you thinking about doing updates to your podcast?
Yeah, that's actually been a big thought. One change in my life is that I joined a group that we're referring to ourselves as the Climate Rapid Response Team, trying to connect journalists with reputable scientists on the subject to correct this improper balance issue out there on the subject. And it's been eye-opening. You mentioned the Republican House move to just say the EPA can't regulate carbon dioxide. It's interesting what's going on right now. So as far as your question, what's going on with the podcast, I'm working on a video podcast to parallel the one that I had done audio, but in the back of my head I'm thinking this climate issue is getting to be so important I might just jumpstart a climate podcast first.
Yeah, I'd subscribe to your climate podcast. All right, listen. The reason why I thought to call you last week is I heard this great statistic or interesting statistic about how much the earthquake in Japan affected larger systems. Now, I'm not talking about local environmental systems, which we're going to cover in a little bit, but more like planetary level.
Global. Yeah.
What happened when this massive amount of energy was released from the seismic activity?
Yeah, this is a history changer. I mean, my lecture that day was completely dumped, and we just watched video on this. It's something I wanted my students to realize. This is going to change the world. It's obviously going to hit the global economic system. It's going to hit the world in other ways, too. There's this NASA report that we've shortened the length of the day, shifted the pole of the axis of rotation.
Just as a point of reference, how much shorter is a day now?
Let me see. They calculated that the day has been shortened by 1.8 microseconds.
Miles, that's about how much the NPR budget cut will affect the national budget.
Well done, sir.
Here's
well done.
On that one. Your moon is dragging on the Earth through tidal friction, and it actually slows down the Earth's rotation by about 1.6 milliseconds per century. So a quick calculation, you'll figure out that this 1.8 microsecond change in our rotation from the Japan earthquake will probably be erased by the moon in about 40 days.
Right.
So we're okay. One-fourth of the way through erasing that issue.
Damn you, moon!
It's not even an observed rotational change. It's a calculated one. You have to calculate it. You can't observe it.
Right. Okay, what about the axis shift, meaning that the point of rotation of the Earth has moved a little bit? Is that something that we can measure?
There's a complication on this one. It's not truly the rotational axis that has shifted. It's the, forgetting my term. It's a special term. The directional axis has been shifted by about 4 inches.
Okay. So can you translate that to a top on a table?
I'm trying to translate that. It's basically going to result in not the north-south axis of the Earth changing, but it's kind of the wobble of the planet as it rotates, changes a little bit. If you were to calculate that as a pure axial shift, 4 inches is about 360 degrees for a circle. You break that into a circle in 1 degree has got 60 minutes, and 1 minute has 60 seconds of arc. Right. We're talking about a shift of about a third of an arc second.
Not very much.
Jupiter has as large as about 50 arc seconds. Okay, so.
You mean from the surface of Earth, the amount
of
age?
Yeah, looking around the 360 degrees around our planet, Jupiter occupies about 50 arc seconds, and we're talking about a shift of a third of an arc second, so 150th of Jupiter.
Thank you for that.
So there's a perspective on all this.
All right, Earth's so those changing. Things don't seem like a big change. What about Japan?
My heart's going out. This is terrible. This is just terrible. At last I heard that it confirmed somewhere around 7,000 dead, 10,000 missing. 2,000 injured.
Mostly from the tsunami,
sure,
right?
From the tsunami, mostly,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, the early numbers, when we first heard it, and we're talking about it in GeekSpeak, we talked about how wonderful, how low the casualty count was, and then realizing over the last week and so that it's not low because there wasn't a lot of deaths. It's just that they always, you know, they're
prepared.
They are very prepared, and we talked a lot about
these things.
Quite impressive, but of course we're still seeing the figures rise, which is horrible.
Yeah.
I'm curious.
Well, of course we're.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I wanted to get away from the side of the human tragedy and kind of talk about the land mass. I'd also heard that Japan moved, if you will, from relation to where it was.
That's true. It can be measured with GPS devices, and it looks like about an 8-foot shift.
That's a lot of distance.
Yeah, east.
Towards the east.
You know, every time there's an earthquake, you're shifting the land, as long as it expresses itself at the surface. And, you know, San Francisco in 1906, there was a 4-foot shift in some places. This one's big, especially since it moved the entire main island of Japan, basically.
The area of mass that Japan is on, what can you describe it kind of from plate tectonics perspective? Where is it? Yeah, what's happening?
Yeah, you're always concerned about plate boundaries. I mean, that's, you know, San Francisco was a plate boundary issue between the North American plate and the Pacific plate. Japan has actually got 4 plates converging.
Whoa.
It's got North American, Eurasian, Indian Asian, I believe, and Pacific, all coming together there. And, yeah, it's a mess. So they're quite prepared for this kind of a thing. Of course, volcanoes go with that as well.
Is Japan created from the plates moving away and volcanic material coming up, or some other form?
It's forming from convergence of two plates, one oceanic plate diving underneath another one.
And pushing the other plate up. Okay.
And, well, it's actually, as it dives down, it drags a lot of sediment with it that's water-laden, and water-laden sediment melts rather easily at relatively low temperatures. So as you get into higher temperatures, you get deeper in the earth, this stuff melts rather easily, comes up as volcanic, so you get this back arc of volcanic islands. And that's basically what Japan is a volcanic island chain.
Okay.
Along with compressional stresses pushing that stuff up, like you said, you know, you get that kind of what we call it, orogenic uplift as well there.
Right. Which one's diving? Which plate is diving under?
The Pacific plate is going underneath. I believe right where it broke, it was going underneath the Eurasian plate.
Okay.
And it broke along a line of about something like 250 miles long, something like that. That's why the whole main island move is such, and why this is so much energy coming out of this thing. A 9 on the Richter scale is.
Almost
we could talk about perspective on that one.
Yeah.
Well, the most energy humans have ever put out is nuclear bombs, and the biggest one ever was in Russia, and it made about a 5.5 on the Richter scale. Richter scale's logarithmic. So what we just saw released about 72,000 times more energy than the biggest nuclear bomb we ever set off.
That is huge. That's one of those things when you watch the video of this. I mean, of course, you're fearful for all these people, and I was also just in awe, just this perspective of wow, we're so insignificant on this planet. I mean, in the sense that we can't even come close to what nature does.
Yeah.
Let's talk about.
It brings home that point that humans live here by geologic consent. Yeah.
Yeah. That's true. So, let's talk a bit about us trying to, you know, manage systems in a situation where we have that kind of. Uncontrol of our environment, right? So let's talk about the plant, nuclear power plant, and the safety guards that were set in place. And of course, they clearly, a lot of them have failed. Are you looking, I mean, when I heard that there was problems in a nuclear reactor, one of my first things was, because not from the perspective of danger for people, because I wasn't so concerned about that at first. What I was really concerned about is the political impact of having another disaster, because I am aware of our insatiable need for energy and the bad effects of carbon burning, for example, and that most people just see nuclear, you know, radiation, bad, 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 don't touch, and this kind of thing, of course, feeds that fear. Did that hit you at all? that perspective?
Yeah, that hit me immediately was, well, and as I watched this progress over the last week, it's gotten worse and worse. And I'm like, well, this is not going to do well for the public opinion on nuclear power plants. You're going to get a big NIMBY response. You know, not in my backyard, you're not building this thing, if it can do that. This is unfortunate. It's always a risk. Really, when you look at the timeline of events on that thing, in some ways it was bad luck if they'd just been able to get the portable generators in time, you know?
Yeah.
They just missed it. And so things started to go bad, and one thing led to another, and it's really bad. One of the issues there actually is with nuclear, one of the problems with it is, what do you do with the nuclear waste, right?
Yeah.
And when you look at the number one method of dealing with nuclear waste, it's on-site storage. We're just kind of holding it at sites, waiting until we can figure out what to do with it, figure out how to make better breeder reactors later to reuse it, something like that.
This is the term of we have pools of water, basically, with containment systems in there. They're relatively
You've got these rods that have been used, and they're sitting in these pools of water to keep them cool. The water's being circulated all throughout to keep it cool, and that's the problem, is when the energy shuts down, you stop circulating, and it overheats, boils away the water, and overheats.
Which is why they're trying to pump in seawater.
What is going on there, what you've got are basically uranium-235 pellets embedded into a zirconium alloy rod, and they're spaced perfectly, so they're not overly critical in a single rod.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a meltdown, you seriously melt these rods, and it's like, you know, your raisins and the raisin bread floating in there. All of a sudden, you melt your bread, all the raisins are going to collapse together, and you're going to start to
reactions. Yeah, let's talk about chain reactions and what that actually means. I mean, if you have a material that's radioactive, you're talking about particles of it decaying into other materials, and when that happens, energy is released, and some particle flies off. And if that particle happens to hit something else that could cause a faster reaction, if you will, then that thing spits out particles, and basically they start colliding. And when you get a situation where it's critical in the sense that it keeps on feeding itself, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter.
Right,
and if you do that,
there's energy being emitted in the form of radiation. There's also neutrons being released as a heavy element of uranium splits apart into lighter elements. And that neutron that goes flying out, if it hits another uranium nucleus, will that one off into a reaction. So, yes, and it'll set off more than one neutron out into the environment. So if you exponentially, you'll start growing the number of reactions. Yeah, that's a chain reaction. So
and
we have
that's
something that captures neutrons, something that's going to keep the neutron count down, which is usually control rods, graphite or something like that. Water itself can be used as a neutron capturer. And that's the problem here, is the rods went in, but the water went out, and you just couldn't control the temperature buildup, and the thing started melting down in a couple of those reactors.
You're listening to Geek Speak. My name's Lyle Troxell. In the air with me, Ben Jaffe and Miles Elam. We're speaking with Christian Shorey. He's a PhD from the University of Iowa. He works at the University of Mines as an instructor and teacher. He's got a great podcast about the Earth and environmental sciences. I highly recommend it. We'll have it up on our Geek Speak website at the end of today's show. Christian.
Yeah.
My first reaction, you know, I've really have this optimistic side about me, about technology. And when a disaster like this happens, it definitely starts questioning, like, am I being naive? Is, you know, I mean, I have to push myself into that space, because my first reaction is, no, we've got this thing down. We can make safe nuclear power plants. So when this kind of thing happens, I go, why did this fail? Do I have to change my worldview, or is something else happening here?
Well, I mean, one of the unfortunate things here is we probably learned a lot of lessons from this in a way that we could probably avoid this from happening if we rebuilt the structure. You know, that's an irony.
Of course, every time one of those disasters happens, that's the response.
Yeah, you learn a lot.
Right.
The danger level, it's not good. It's not good, but it's not horrendous. It's not globally devastating. I have heard reports that there's been heightened radiation levels drifting into your area in California, but I tell your listeners, don't worry about it at all. It is so much background, low level. It's your risks are the amount of exposure, time of exposure, and if you think about the main elements that are coming out of that thing that are radioactive, they have half-lives of about 8 days.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah. And if you take potassium iodide pills, they can make you sick.
Don't take it.
Yeah,
that
should be pointed out. Potassium iodide is, you're putting the iodine into your thyroid quicker than the radioactive iodine-131 could get in. However, that can start messing with your endocrine system and lead to hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, diarrhea, other side effects that you may not find pleasant. So
yeah, we have a doctor who was on before us, Dr. Dawn Motika, and her show's podcast too. She covered a bit of this, and she gave me a link about dealing with trying to detoxicate your body from radiation, different types of radiation.
Detoxicate?
Well, that's what I know. That's the thing that got me so frustrated. It says how to detox your body, and the detox is that
detoxify.
Okay, fine.
Detoxify, yeah.
Thanks. I don't like that term because you infer there's toxins. But I guess if you have radioactive contamination in your body system, you do want to get rid of it. One of the thoughts is, right off the bat, scary technology coming, in Japan, but of course it's really about nuclear power plants. There's this fear based around it because, well, why are we doing it this way? We should make it safer and easier and all that. But, I want to shift for a second and talk about our main power source here in California. It's some Diablo Canyon, which is a nuclear power plant, but a lot of it's actually coal, and it's just the burning of coal. And what I've heard is that you actually produce a lot of radioactivity from coal burning. Is that true?
Well, it used to be before we got scrubbers in place. that's not a big risk anymore either. I mean, the scrubbers take out the fly ash, with most of your heavy metals in it that might have your radioactive materials concentrated in it. And you can put that into what we call a secure landfill. So
we're able to bury it because it's not concentrated.
Yeah, coal burning fire power plants these days, I mean, the main problem is the CO2 emission.
Right. Which, unlike the nuclear power plant disaster, is a global impact.
Yeah, exactly. It will have a large effect. And when you look at the distribution of our energy consumption sources, fossil fuels are by far the majority for electric utilities and transportation mainly. And then renewables, they're so slight. It's so very, very small right now. I'm all for going for renewables, but the idea that we'll turn into a renewable energy economy in 20, 30 years, that magnitude of a transformation, it's really hard for me to conceive. I mean, maybe in 100 years we'll do a slow transformation to get a balance 50-50.
All right, Christian, what about in your backyard? Would you live next to a nuclear power plant, a newly created one?
No, we have coal burning around here.
And if you had a choice, what would you live next to?
Yeah, I would love to go for more renewables.
So even though it's not very possible for us to switch over in 20 or 30 years, just because the numbers are so astronomical, you would say if you could do anything you want, that would be what you'd go for.
If we proposed a nuclear power plant here, I'd have no problem with it. Mm-hmm. Of course, I would consider things like, what are the risks of earthquakes, tsunamis around here in Golden, Colorado?
I think you're okay with tsunamis.
Bad for the tsunamis. Earthquakes are still possible, but those things, I mean, if you notice what happened with the earthquake in Japan, the buildings survived the earthquake.
Yeah.
The earthquake didn't really do the damage. It was the tsunamis taking out the generators that started everything downhill.
You know, before the show started, the geeks and I were chatting, and I said, well, couldn't they have just doubled the level of energy they could take before the flooding would happen? And I think Ben said, yeah, but it's logarithmic, so it's only another one, right? So what if there was a 10, and then you lost? You know, it's really
for that matter, what happens if you go for a 9.0 earthquake and there's a 9.1?
Right, and you've just failed again.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Is it possible for us to make nuclear power plants completely safe?
You're asking a scientist about an absolute certainty. That's not really fair.
Boy, I don't think perfectly safe is ever the word when you're dealing with nuclear.
Wait, let me preface this with another question. Is there any type of large-scale power generation that will be completely safe?
Good point. No.
Now,
well, no. Let me ask the scientist, right. The one who has.
No, I mean it really is a matter of every move you make is going to hurt somebody. Yeah. I hate to put it in those terms. It's so Machiavellian, but you know, hey. The least harm does seem to come from the renewables, but we have to do that smart as well. You know, I hear our president harping on ethanol still, and I grimace every time. Yeah.
Well, tell me about ethanol. What do you mean? Why do you grimace?
Oh, ethanol. Well, I mean, the fact that you're upping your corn prices because of this, also that you're using fossil fuels to actually farm that corn. That where I came from in Iowa, we had something called the Conservation Reserve Program, CRP, would pay farmers money to not farm their land, let it go back to natural state. As soon as ethanol came in, the price for corn went up, the farmers went, I can get more money from farming that land than I can get from CRP. So they went back to farming, and I pretty much guarantee you the flooding that's been going on in Iowa lately, not caused by this, but probably made worse by more land being converted from natural back to farming because of ethanol.
I mean, farming is actually a giant impact on the environment. I mean,
yeah. And then I'll just mention that you burn ethanol, it puts more ozone out than gasoline. So ozone at the tropospheric level is bad, and you know, it's just bad. It's not good. It's not working out.
to translate ozone at a lower level, when you create ozone at the surface level, it doesn't get up to where we want it. It's in the space where we don't want it. It's a pollutant.
Yeah, we want it up in the stratosphere to protect us, not down here where it causes respiratory difficulties. Yeah,
exactly. Well, Christian, thank you so much for doing your podcast. I'm looking forward to your video podcast. Is there any closing remarks you'd like to make about the disaster in Japan, about nuclear power, or any other topic that's on top of your mind lately?
Well, I'll say that Japan has historically always been a country that has been there for other countries when it's been a time of need and disaster, so time for us to do the same for them.
Yep, they're definitely here for Katrina.
Yeah,
definitely. Thank you very much. All right. Thank you. I hope to have you on again with another, with hopefully a brighter topic at hand.
That would be nice.
Great. Thank you so much, Christian.
All right. You take care.
Bye-bye. Christian Shorey is a professor at the School of Mines in Colorado. He's got a wonderful podcast called Earth Environmental Science, and he talks about, you know, the dawn of the age all the way through to where we are and all the different interactions between. If you want to hear about how the Earth works, start there. It's fascinating. It's up on our website, geekspeak.org.
And if you want more information about the nuclear reactor in Japan that was having all these problems recently, I highly recommend the website for the Nuclear Energy Institute. I'll put the link up on the website. It keeps the editorial down to a bare minimum. It just talks about what is the state of affairs, what's going on, what does the reactor look like, what are the different pieces to it. It's a great resource. I highly recommend it.
And we'll have that up on the site. Also, a little story I'll put up about a kind of a science blog story about a person that posted like what actually happened, and then we found out later that it wasn't actually accurate, and then the correction, and now it's being kind of vetted, and it's another great source for more information on the nuclear power plant disaster in Japan. Miles and Ben, thank you so much for being here today with me.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you.
One more call we didn't get to. My mother called to wish me a happy birthday. Thanks, Mom. Hey, GeekSpeak on KOSP is supported by CruiseIO Internet. CruiseIO powers broadband DSL and websites for thousands of local homes and businesses. CruiseIO Internet, technology for the next 20 years. More information online at CruiseIO.com. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at KOSP.org. All the content we talked about is at geekspeak.org. Coming up next is Car Talk. Car Talk on KOSP is made possible by a grant from the Holly Family Fund at the Community Foundation of Santa Cruz County, and we appreciate their support. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of online tonight with David Lawrence, and we appreciate the Puppet Masters allowing us to use the name. Miles, Ben, thank you so much for KOSP and for GeekSpeak. I'm Lyle Troxell. We'll see you next week.